This is the takeaway for Wednesday, May 31st, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It was a bit of an awkward circus of angry tweets and unexpected optics, as President Donald Trump seems to have rattled the apple cart in Europe during his recent overseas trip. But don't tell that to presidential spokesman Sean Spicer.
It was an unprecedented first trip abroad, just 4 months into this administration. And it shows how quickly and decisively the president is acting to strengthen alliances, to form new partnerships, and to rebuild America's standing in the world.
It's not completely clear if Spicer was referring to the range of Trump tweets following talks with NATO and G7 leaders, lambasting the news media, North Korea, leakers, and as to Germany, Trump wrote, "We have a massive trade deficit with Germany, plus they pay far less than they should on NATO and military. Very bad for U.S. This will change," he tweeted this on Tuesday. At first glance, German Chancellor Angela Merkel seemed to have thrown up her hands following last week's meetings with the U.S. president.
"The times in which we could completely depend on others are, to a certain extent, over."
Chancellor Merkel went on to say that Europe must, quote, "take its fate into its own hands." Is the leader of Germany giving up on cooperation with the United States and its allies?
I'm sorry. No, this is just not true. What she was saying was, quite precisely, we cannot in the future always unconditionally rely on America and the United States. So what she was saying is that these allies have both become less dependable than they used to be. She also said quite explicitly that the door would always be open and that we would always want to cooperate with them, but that we'd have to be able, put ourselves in a position, enable ourselves to rely on ourselves more regularly.
Veteran analyst Constanze Stelzenmüller insisted that U.S.-European relations are in good shape despite the Trump style. She is the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Mabel Barazin is a sociology professor at Cornell University and author most recently of Illiberal Politics in Neoliberal Times. In assessing this first round of Trump-style diplomacy with these two seasoned pros, Constanze Stelzenmüller expressed shock that President Trump seemed to be completely unaware of how much Europe has been quietly moving toward his positions.
What Trump is just ignoring and ignored in that speech in Brussels was that actually America and Europe have been working together on enabling Europe to take on a greater part of its own security burden. We agree on this, and we have been doing a lot. And this American president makes it seem as though, A, we disagreed, B, we're doing nothing, B, we're reckless and feckless free riders. That is simply untrue. And what offended Europeans so much was that he said all this standing in front of the memorial for Europe's commitment to America when Europe invoked Article 5, the Mutual Defense Clause, after 9/11. And in the Afghan war that followed, nearly 900 Europeans lost their lives fighting alongside America.
Professor Barazin?
I actually do think that there are two things going on there. I mean, I think there is the sense of offense that he doesn't know history. And I also think there's a kind of sense of moral superiority that he's generating. In part, it's connected to his lack of knowledge. But there is this sense that people feel that he is stepping on toes as he goes around and that he's potentially dangerous, not only to the transatlantic alliance, but to the various features of international trade, economics, and that sort of thing.
Before we talk about the danger and the potential dangers there, from both of you, I'm wondering if you could react to what a lot of historians have said is Trump represents the end of liberal politics coming from the United States and the evangelical sort of advocacy of liberal democracy in Europe and elsewhere in the world. Would you agree that that is the case, Constanze?
No, I think that's wildly exaggerated. I think that certainly Angela Merkel and Europeans in general make a distinction between this president and America and this president and at least some of his advisors in the White House. It's true that this president and some advisors appear to hold what one can only call Darwinian views. of competition, even with allies, and an approach to allies and trusted traditional allies like the Europeans and like the Germans that is transactional rather than based on a sense of values and not just of shared interests. And that, I think, is a genuine shift. The other thing that I think Europeans worry about is that the reason America was able to get its allies and its friends to follow its course when it set a direction was that there was always a sense that the post-war America was creating and protecting a liberal world order for the sake not just of itself and of its own people, but of greater peace and prosperity in the world. In other words, something larger than just a single country, even a large superpower like America. And that's a commitment that right now is not being referenced a lot by this White House, and it's being noticed in Europe.
I would go beyond it's not being referenced. It's almost unknown by this White House. I mean, I think one of the really serious issues here is that what the current administration has really done is in many ways compromise the secular moral authority of the United States in the post-war era, in which this liberal world order is codes for in a way. And that is actually, I think, unique to this particular administration. I have a hard time imagining that this is sort of the end of the world as we knew it, as it were. I don't believe that this administration's values, such as they are, these transactional values, are going to continue, because this administration in so many ways is an outlier. And it's very difficult to imagine that it has the capacity, the intellectual capacity, to wipe out the past 60, 70 years of international relations. I do think that we are in a moment that we have to be concerned about on both sides of the Atlantic. But I think we need to be careful about ceding too much moral authority or power to this particular administration.
I've looked at a lot of the comparisons of notes out of meetings between foreign leaders and the president of the United States, and the differences between one interpretation and the other is often quite striking. Any assessment that Sean Spicer said yesterday that Angela Merkel and President Trump get along very well? Any credibility to that, either Professor Berezin or Costanza?
Look, yes, my impression is that that is actually correct. Angela Merkel and President Trump have been on the phone quite a lot. They've established, I think, a cordial working relationship. I think that Angela Merkel's remarks in Germany, which also need to be seen in the context of an election in 4 months, where she is trying to make sure that her opponent isn't enabled by Trump's speech in Brussels to make this a anti-Americanism a key element of his campaign. But I think that we need to assume that there will continue to be a good working relationship between America and Germany, but one that will be probably more transactional and more realist on both sides.
Comment on to the Paris climate change and the NATO mutual defense pledge, Professor Berezin? Are those solid? And certainly the climate change, the Paris Climate Change Accord has been delayed, a decision has been delayed from the White House on that. I don't know if you view that as positive.
Well, I don't view anything as positive or negative coming out of this particular White House. I just want to go back a little bit to the last question. I think the optics here on the my expertise is in politics and political communication, and I think the optics on the German-Trump relation are very important, and I agree that there is this election in Germany coming up and that the politics are important, but the optics have not been particularly good on that. And I think that's the case with other leaders also in Europe. He certainly is forcing a rethinking of what it means to be liberal, what it means to be democratic, what it means to interact in the international arena. I think that's a good thing. Also, obviously, in the national arena. But I have a very hard time looking at him as the end of, you know, what's gone before. And he may be a bridge to something new, and he may force a rethinking, but I don't really see him in the kind of apocalyptic terms.
Mabel Berezin is sociology professor at Cornell University. Final thoughts, Constanza, on the climate change accord. There was a lot of excitement that that accord represented a real solid
achievement
in international cooperation as well as environmental policy. Where do you think it's headed?
So two things. On the previous question, it seems to me, and I'm a constitutional lawyer by training, I wrote my German doctoral thesis on American constitutional law. It does seem to me that this president has challenged fundamental principles of representative democracy, limited government, protection of minorities, freedom of the press in this constitutional order in unprecedented ways. As for the climate accord, media today are suggesting that sources in the White House are saying that the president is preparing to step away from it, to cancel America's participation in it. Meanwhile, the Indians appear to be offering to join.
What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, in a previous age, it would have been the other way around.
That the Indians would have pulled out and the U.S. would have stayed in.
Yes, the Indians would never have joined, and that the U.S. would have stayed in. And again, I think a lot of Europeans would have found that in line with the tradition of America leading and expanding and adapting a liberal global order that is at the service of all of mankind and not just of the interests of one country.
Constanza Stelzenmüller is Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Constanza and Mabel, thank you so much for a candid conversation.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And what you are hearing are military aircraft surveying the damage in central Kabul from a huge car bomb that went off during rush hour near the Afghan presidential palace today. Scores dead, hundreds wounded. Civilians say they could feel the impact of the explosion a mile away, and it's dangerously close to several foreign embassies. In the first week of Ramadan, the Taliban has often used the beginning of the holy month to rattle the fragile Afghan government, but the Taliban said they were not behind this bombing. Joining us now is Mujib Mashal, senior correspondent for the New York Times in Kabul.
First, the sheer size of the explosion was pretty massive, and just windows were shattered. From what we gather, in about a radius of about a mile from the exact site of the explosion. And as I was driving into work this morning when the explosion happened, I could see shopkeepers just sweeping broken glass and families rushing young children, panicking children from school back to home. And the whole area of downtown Kabul where the explosion happened, near the presidential palace and near foreign embassies, that area was cordoned off for a long while. But the impact of the explosion was felt across a very wide part of the city.
So the embassies were targeted, the city itself was targeted, and this was timed to have the greatest amount of casualties, it would seem.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly clear yet who the specific target was, because the presidential palace is there, the embassies are there, but there are also civilian targets there. There are banks, there are shopping centers, there are television channels, and it's a very busy roundabout, especially that time of the morning. It happened around 8:20 in the morning. That's when people are making their way to work, and that is one of the reasons why the death toll, but also the number of wounded is so high.
In terms of the people in Kabul and Afghan citizens, what's their assessment of the stability of civil society right now?
Well, it's on the one hand, when you go to the countryside, it is very clear that the government is losing territory to the Taliban. There are villages in the countryside that are sort of switching hands back and forth every couple of months. And that takes a massive toll over the local population, where at a certain point after being trampled over by each side, they no longer care who is the side that's ruling them. But then in the urban centers, you have attacks like this where, yes, enormous number of casualties, but also the panic it causes directly then reflects on the government's ability to be able to protect civilians. So overall, 16 years into this war, not only is the countryside not safe, but the urban centers keep on getting targeted, which certainly reflects on the ability of the government.
I mean, you could have easily been caught in this, even though you were on your way to work. What are your personal feelings about all this?
Our offices are about 500 meters from the site of the explosion. And when I arrived, most of the glass was smashed. So our staff spend half of the morning clearing glass. And that was the case with a lot of other offices. But thankfully, our staff are safe. The same can't be said about our colleagues at the BBC. They lost a driver and four of their journalists were wounded as they were driving to work. And several other of the news organizations in the area, Tolo News, a local news channel, they lost a colleague in the attack because, again, it was that morning rush hour where everybody was driving to work. And this is actually one of the three possible streets to our office. And I agree, it could have very well been any of us. But we are thankful to be safe, and it's a sad day that we have lost colleagues in the journalism community.
Well, our sympathies and prayers are with you here on this very early days in Ramadan. Mujib Mashal, thanks so much for speaking with us.
All right, thank you.
Now, a military milestone that the Army apparently isn't terribly enthusiastic about sharing with the world. The first group of women ever to graduate from the U.S. Army's infantry training for enlisted soldiers was certified as combat ready earlier this month. The 18 women from a class of about 140 completed the grueling program more than 4 years after the Obama administration ordered the Pentagon to open all combat positions to women. Partly because the Army did not lower a single standard for the women recruits, unlike other training programs for women in the U.S. military, the dropout rate among female recruits was 44%, more than double the men. Among the tests, hurling a grenade 35 meters, dragging a 268-pound dummy 15 meters, running 5 miles in less than 45 minutes while carrying 68 pounds. Ellen Herring is a West Point graduate and retired Army colonel. She's now director of the Service Women's Action Network and has been an advocate for women in combat for years.
I see this as a huge milestone, even though the Army is trying to play it down. I think it's a little bit different from what I went through in the early 80s when the first women were graduating from West Point. When we went through, there were different standards, physical fitness standards, not across the board, but just in certain areas that built some resentment. In the current situation, though, the Army's learned a lot of lessons, and the women and the men are meeting the exact same requirements for these various combat occupations. And so I think that's a big equalizer, and it's not only a historic event, but it was a smart move on the Army's part. I wish we'd done it many years ago.
And it was something that women who participated in this program insisted upon, I would think.
Well, in fact, there is still a hair standard difference, so the women don't have to get their hair shaved when they go through these courses. However, many of them have elected to get their heads shaved so in solidarity with their male counterparts. That's one of the few areas where there is still an existing different standard that, like I said, it sometimes builds resentment when guys don't want to get their heads shaved either. So I think the Army still got to work through some of this. But I love the fact that many of the women in the current classes have shaved their heads in solidarity with their male peers.
What do you make of the 44% dropout rate?
Well, I think that's always to be expected, especially in the first classes. We're still ironing things out. We're still working on the entrance standards. So in other words, when recruits show up to a recruiting station, they're now being put through a series of physical tests called the OPAT. I think it's Occupational Physical Assessment Test. That didn't happen before. We're trying to screen recruits to determine whether or not they have the physical capacity for these high-demand occupations. And maybe we don't have the screening fully set yet. So the fact that 44% of women fail doesn't surprise me. I think you'll see the numbers drop over time. We have certainly seen that happen with the combat engineers and especially the Army Sapper course. Initially, a lot of women were failing because they were showing up and they weren't prepared. But as the standards become clearer and the screening gets better, the women's graduation rates from the Army Sapper course are approximately the same as the men's. So I expect to see that the rates will equalize more as time goes by, although it's likely that women will never make it at the exact same rate simply because of the physical size difference.
And of the combat forces that would be a part of active duty service members in uniform, where would these individuals go? Would they just be put in various infantry units? Would they be in command units? Is there a special unit that would be made up mostly of women? How is this going to be organized?
Sure. So the way the Army is rolling this out is that the women in the first infantry and armor courses in the pipeline are going to two units. They're going to the 82nd at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and they're going to the 1st Cav at Fort Hood, Texas. They're being assigned just like their male peers. As far as I know, there isn't any specific unit within the 82nd that's taking on the women, except that they have tried to begin to fill out units one at a time with female leaders so that there's women in leadership positions in those units before they introduce the first enlisted women. So the first women officers actually graduated from the infantry and armor courses last fall. They're now at the 82nd and the 1st Cav when these new enlisted infantry women will join those units.
In the lead up to this milestone, the military has had to become much more vigilant about the potential for sexual abuse in all of the services. What's the track record so far in the early going for this group?
I haven't heard of any problems right now with the first initial training groups in terms of harassment or assault, particularly military sexual assault. Which is wonderful in my book. What we do know historically is that countries, communities, organizations that are more equal have lower rates of harassment and assault against women. So I think that this is the last step that the military needs to take in order to create a level playing field that reduces harassment and assault.
You're a retired colonel and have worked very hard as an advocate for women in combat. Yet I'm wondering if deep down, you wish maybe you were born a couple of decades, maybe later than your birthday actually was.
You know, people have asked me that. Some of my classmates at West Point have said, hey, if it were an option, would you have gone infantry or armor? And honestly, I don't know what the answer would be. What I would have wanted was at least to have had the choice or the option. And what's interesting is women have been doing a lot of these very physically demanding and challenging activities for a long time without being able to actually join the infantry. So way back in the 80s, I was an air assault qualified, which means I could rappel out of helicopters, did those long distances carrying equipment. And then women have been going through airborne school and sapper training school, Pathfinder's course for decades. So this isn't something brand new to what women have been required to do, but opening the infantry as an occupation is.
You made the point that the Army isn't making much of this. Do you think the Army's playing this down?
Yes, definitely the Army's playing it down. I think it's fortunate and unfortunate. Here's why it's fortunate. They're trying to reduce the attention that's focused on these women because they don't want any kind of negative blowback or resentment and the sense that, oh, they only did this to draw attention to themselves. So I think they've played it down for that reason. But I also think that there's a problem with playing it down, and that is that this is historic. And if we want to recruit more women, we need to make it clear to women that it's happening and that they're welcome and that this is what you need to do to be able to join these kinds of occupations. So I'm a little disappointed with the level of media coverage. It was almost non-existent. And I think that's unfortunate from a recruiting perspective, because those women who are in there, who just graduated, talked about how as soon as they heard that it was open, they wanted that. So more women need to know that. They'll be inspired by them.
Ellen Herring, West Point graduate and retired Army colonel, is now director of the Service Women's Institute for the Service Women's Action Network and advocate for women in combat. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Citizens in Florida may soon get the chance to correct, that's in quotes, the schoolwork of their children in public schools. It's up to the governor now to decide whether to sign a bill approved by the legislature that would allow residents to force teachers to offer alternative approaches to climate change, evolution, subjects parents and citizens disagree with, and represent views far outside the scientific mainstream. Two other states have already approved similar academic freedom laws, bills that actually compel teachers to present multiple views on topics like evolution or climate change. Glenn Branch, deputy director of the National Center for Science Education, calls this an emergency at a time when for years science and STEM education have been seen as more important than ever before. This would be a serious setback.
We defend the integrity of science education against ideological attacks. In Florida, there was an attempt, a successful attempt, to make it easier for people to challenge the use of instructional materials in their local schools. And it was quite clear that among their targets were evolution and climate change. In an affidavit that they submitted in favor of this legislation, they complained, I have witnessed students being taught evolution as fact rather than theory. I have witnessed children being taught that global warming is a reality. And that apparently is something that they'd like to do something about.
And from your perspective, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. In fact, that would be the proper way of addressing those issues.
That's right. And we're hopeful that even despite the passage of the bill, school districts will reject such complaints as unwarranted. The problem is they're now going to have to be forced to jump through hoops to satisfy the requirements of the law. It makes it easier for challenges like this to be raised and requires school districts to afford due process to the people raising those challenges.
Does the educational publications and curriculum industry have a vested interest in maintaining this, you know, alternative view of evolution and climate change? Are there materials that are out there to easily satisfy parents who are dissatisfied with what seems to be settled scientific questions?
There are a variety of educational or miseducational materials giving different ideas about evolution and climate change. It's unlikely that a district could be forced to adopt them, but they might be pressured to compromise or downplay evolution and climate change in their curriculum as a result of the passage of this bill.
Do local school officials have the authority to do whatever they want in this matter?
Not whatever they want, because they are, after all, public servants, and they're responsive to their constituents and their voters. They can't just do anything. They can't, for example, require or allow creationism to be taught, because that would violate the First Amendment of the Constitution. But there are a lot of ways in which the integrity of science education can be compromised, and we may see more of them in play in Florida.
And would that include explicit mandates on the part of Florida law to allow parents to bring in whatever materials that they would like, or is it going to remain this sort of partial solution here?
They're not going to be allowed to bring in whatever they like. They are going to be allowed, and it's going to be easier for them, to challenge instructional materials that are in use, complaining that they're not accurate, balanced, or non-inflammatory. And school districts will have to react to that, even if it's to tell them no.
Are there actual families who would have concerns? And have you spoken to such family members? And on the other side, if some scientifically inclined family member were to see an alternative instructional material come into a classroom, have they reached out to you and expressed their thoughts?
Well, we've heard from a variety of teachers who are concerned. We've heard from a few school board members. We've heard from parents. But no one has yet said, this is what is now happening. Can you help? But we will be ready to do so when that happens.
Glenn Branch is deputy director of the National Center for Science Education. Glenn, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
If you're a parent, teacher, or even a student, are you seeing debates over science curriculum playing out in schools? Valerie, a public high school teacher of earth science in Michigan, says she recently got a message from a parent upset that she was teaching about climate change. Before she called the parent back, she talked to her class. Here's what she told them.
I hear there's been some confusion, but let me tell you this. We're not teaching politics here. We're teaching climate change. There's no disputing that the Earth's average temperature is rising. The dispute is who's caused it and whose fault it is. And in all honesty, I don't care. Because in the end, it's about our survival. Whether you believe it or not is irrelevant. I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm asking you to understand it. Never heard from the parent again.
Here's Leanne Erickson, an honors biology teacher in Moscow, Idaho.
I already know that if their family is just anti-climate change, then I'm not necessarily going to get to change their opinion. I would like to. And in some ways, I'm not too worried about it. They have the facts. They can still pull on those later on in their lives. I have students in my class who think the world is 6,000 years old. So I can't really change their opinion as 10th graders, but I can change the way they think about controversial issues.
And here's John, an environmental science teacher at a Catholic school in Louisiana.
In any case, any issue, especially if you can't see it clear-cut black and white, then I think debate is good. Just know the facts, get the facts from as many sources as you can, look at both sides.
What's your experience here?
My name is Michael, and I'm calling from Kutztown, Pennsylvania. I'm a very concerned environmentalist. As a former teacher, I'm dismayed that our schools are not focused like a laser on what is surely becoming a global crisis.
My name is Sina. Currently, I am residing in Denver. We don't have much of a problem with our school's curriculum regarding evolution or the current global climate situation because we homeschool. And it's one of the reasons I do homeschool, so that I can verify and I can make sure that my children get current, factual, scientific information.
Our health team here at WNYC Radio is eager to hear from you, whether you're a parent, teacher, or student. If you're upset or concerned about the science curriculum in your school or your kid's school, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or weigh in on our Facebook page. Moonshots have long become the metaphor for big science.
And the goal is, whatever breakthroughs we could make in 10 years, my goal is to make sure we can do it in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. The Moonshot Project to Cure Cancer, spoken about there by Joe Biden, the former vice president, may take quite a bit longer than the 8 years it took to get to the moon once President Kennedy committed us to that mission in 1962. But maybe the real challenge is an upcoming Sunshot mission from NASA. More than 50 years after the initial proposal, NASA says it will fly directly into the sun's atmosphere with a small, very sophisticated spacecraft named the Parker Solar Probe, after the nearly 90-year-old astrophysicist Eugene Parker, who identified the high-speed solar wind. It will orbit within 4 million miles of the sun's surface. It will feel some of that solar wind and face hotter, more radioactive conditions than anything NASA has launched before. Dr. Nikki Fox is the Parker Solar Probe Project scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory and discusses the plans for this very ambitious mission.
The sun is just a magical place for us. It is our neighborhood star, and it really governs everything that happens to us here on Earth. The sun is more than just sunlight. The outer layer of the sun, the corona, which you can see during an eclipse, gets suddenly accelerated and moves away from the sun and bathes all of the planets. So that means when the sun has a lot of activity and maybe throws off a big bunch of solar material, it can actually travel with this solar wind, we call it, and impact our planet and cause many space weather events for us.
And the corona and the sun's atmosphere are interchangeable terms in this context?
Yes.
And what is in the sun's atmosphere that's different from what would be actually on the sun? I guess we would be in the middle of a bunch of very hot and nasty plasma if we were on the surface of the sun.
The sun itself has a very dense core where basically nuclear reactions are going on all the time. And the particles move out towards the surface of the sun. One of our big mysteries is the surface of the sun is just shy of 6,000 degrees. And yet when you move away from it, the corona, the temperatures actually reach 2 to 3 million. And so that's like breaking the laws of nature. You know, if you put your hand by a campfire, it's really hot. As you pull away from it, it gets cooler. For us, with the sun, as you move away from the sun, suddenly it gets hotter. And that's one of the mysteries that we are going to go study.
So what are the possible explanations for something like that?
There are many theories and explanations that have been proposed for why we would see this mystery in the corona. So far, none of them have really held up. You can imagine that you could make something really hot for a short time, but to actually maintain that temperature difference is kind of a mystery. So what we'll be doing with our mission, Solar Probe, is traveling right into this region where kind of the magic happens, and finally visiting and taking the measurements that will be able to determine what theory or what explanation is correct, or indeed maybe it's a combination of all of them.
Is it a compact little probe, or are you going to have to, put up some sort of, sail of some kind, a kind of sensor that is a little more fragile, that would collect particles and get more data than just something that would be on the order of a capsule?
The spacecraft itself is very small. It's actually about a meter across for the main bus. But on the top of that, we have, it looks a bit like an umbrella structure, and that holds our heat shield, which will protect us from the very harsh environment. So from stem to stern, she's about 3.5 meters tall, but the actual bus where all the instruments are housed is pretty small at the back. We need that because, one, we need to stay in the shadow of the heat shield, so we need to be nice and compact, but also we're traveling so fast in order to be able to kind of surf around the sun and not get pulled into the sun. So we need to be very light so we can be thrown fast off our launch vehicle. So that really governs the size of the spacecraft.
Now, Mercury has been pretty darn successful not plunging into the sun, being so close to it. How much closer would this probe get?
The spacecraft herself will travel to about 10 solar radii above the surface, or it's a little shy of 4 million miles. Now, that sounds not that close, but if you put the Earth and the sun 1 meter apart, the probe would be at 4 centimeters away from the sun. So that kind of gives you an idea for how close we're going.
Well, I'm impressed. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we're 93 million miles away from the sun, and this would be 4 million miles, right?
Right.
Yeah,
that's
impressive. I don't think anyone's going to argue with that.
So we're about 7 times closer than anything has ever been before. So roughly 7 times closer than the planet Mercury.
And what would surprise you about the composition of the corona itself?
I think we're going to find many surprises when we actually get to the sun. With our remote sensing, we've done a very good job of characterizing, the metals and the particles and the ions that are in the sun's corona. So, I think we'll go and we'll find pretty much what we expect for the population. But I think there are going to be many processes that are going on. We'll be probably lots of wave functions, so a little bit like radio waves coming from the sun. I think we'll learn a lot from just the interaction between the particles that make up the sun's corona and all the different processes that are going on around them.
And how do you keep from having the sun interfere with any signal that you're trying to get to Earth?
The actual downlink of the science data is challenging because we've gone to the sun, and that is a large glowing radiating body that is often between us and the probe itself. So it makes it kind of challenging, but whenever the probe comes close to the Earth, we lock onto it and downlink all the data at that point. So we don't really do anything when the spacecraft's on the other side of the sun.
You're pretty jazzed about this whole thing, I gather.
I am very jazzed. It's an unbelievably exciting mission. I love to call it the coolest, hottest mission under the sun.
Why did it take 50 years to actually get it together when the moonshot itself took 8 years?
So the mission itself was first proposed in 1958. So when we launch next year, it will be 60 years in the making for this mission.
No kidding.
And it really is just because we've had to wait for the technology to make the leaps in order to be able to withstand these huge temperatures at the sun. So, for example, we had to almost invent the material that is in the heat shield, because not only does it have to withstand temperatures of about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, we do 24 orbits and they're highly elliptical. So we go very close to the sun on one side and then out around sort of Venus's orbit on the other. So actually you've got big temperature differentials as well. So you've got 24 cycles of going very hot and very cold. And to be able to come up with materials that do that, it's not just something that's sitting on your workbench. They're very special materials. And so if you think about in 1958, you would have had a rotary phone that was attached to the wall. And now you walk around with your iPhone 7 that does absolutely everything for you. That's the leap in technology that we've needed to be able to do this mission.
Dr. Fox, thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Nikki Fox is the Parker Solar Probe Project Scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. You can comment on anything you hear on the program, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back to you personally. Tweet me your questions at Jay Hockenberry. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast fix. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time.